PPI.org.
Thank you for joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of the show. My apologies for the late start. Well, someday I'll get the hang of this new stuff. And tonight we have some great people in, well, at least one great person. And of course, my research person is great. Christine Stark. Good evening, Christine. Are you there?
Hello.
Oh, yay, yay. Charlene Dahl is my research team. Good evening, Charlene.
Good evening, everyone.
Oh, there you go. Christine is an author, and she has had many books. And her latest one that we will be talking about is called Carnival Lights. Thank you for joining me, Christine. I really appreciate that. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it has been. I was just thinking that. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So let's start out. Give me a little bit of history about you and how you got into writing.
Well, I grew up here in Minnesota, and I had a situation. I was born into a family that had some members that were involved in sex trafficking and other forms of sexual violence. And so I grew up in a lot of violence, and I got out of that as an older teenager, actually by going to college in another town.
Jeez.
And so I've been working as a teacher, a writer, an advocate around issues of violence, particularly in the Native community. I'm Anishinaabe Cherokee and white heritage.
All right. Thank you. I want to talk about your writing. Your first book, I'm going to touch on it, and we did interview on it, Nichols and A Tale of Dissociation. Can you tell me what that was? I believe that was your first, as far as I knew, real intense book, that at least to me it was about pretty intense topics. And what was that like to start writing on those very powerful topics like that?
Yeah, that was my first novel, and it was written mostly without punctuation. It's kind of like a novel of prose poems.
Uh-huh.
And there's aspects of it obviously that are really intense. Mm-hmm. Because it follows the character from age 5 until she's 25.
Right.
And I really wrote it because I wanted people to have an idea of what it's like to survive that kind of extreme violence and the impact that it can have on, your experience, basically, of the world, really.
Mm.
And although it's a very intense subject, it's not, just violence and just abuse, because there's many more aspects to any human being than just those things.
Right.
And I actually had a really, parts of it were difficult to write, but because of the freedom of the style, mm-hmm. As a writer, I really enjoyed writing it. It was very freeing, and it was nice to not be constrained by, a punctuation and so on. It was enjoyable, actually.
I presume it's fairly therapeutic in many ways.
Yeah. The character in the story is not me. I mean, we have some similarities, but she's a fictional character,
right? But a survivor nonetheless.
And yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think anytime, at least speaking for myself, you know, anytime that I can put something out there that I feel like is bringing some sort of justice, some sort of deeper understanding, some sort of healing for people, that's always a really, it's always a really good feeling for me.
You tend to write about these very intense, powerful subjects. And I understand why. I mean, you kind of lived a lot of them. I would think it feels like it could be very exposing in a way, even though the characters are not you. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, I think Nichols felt maybe a little bit more that way for me. Plus, it was my first novel, and you know, I was writing about subjects that, well, you know, when you write about or talk about dissociation and the ways that people process and live with being traumatized, right?
Right.
You know, there's a lot of people who they don't want anything to do with it with you. They shun you. They look at you like you're crazy. You know, people just don't want to deal with the topic. And that was a bigger issue for me then. It was also 2012 that it came out. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that was much more of a feeling of exposure than Carnival Lights is.
Did you feel like people were like that to you?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, not everybody.
Right, but,
you know,
obviously.
You can have one person react to you like that and 300 react to you by saying, thank you, that was amazing. And, you know, that one person kind of sticks with you more,
sure,
right?
Sure,
sure. So, you know, I don't mean like it was just like every time I turned around, it was this terrible experience.
No, right.
But, you know, it's hard to process. It's hard to deal with putting yourself out there like that, whether it's your own personal story or whether it's a fictionalized character. It you know, like you're saying, it's hard to put yourself out there like that.
Yes.
I did have someone come up to me about Nichols and say, you don't seem crazy. And I was like, well, thanks.
Oh my.
I was
yeah.
like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. I just ignore them. What are you gonna do?
What do you do? Where do you put the things, you know, like you talked about? I'm sure you've had many, many people say, thank you. This is, I've lived this, or I've, you know, been there, or I survived it. And then you're right. It is true. The one or two people that say something for some reason, some ridiculous reason, we relive and relive that. What do you do with that? Where do you put it?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I just get so much healing out of being a part of the Anishinaabe community, going to ceremonies, and that I get more and more healing. You know, every year I get more and more healing by following those ways and having teachings and learning and walking, you know, walking that path of healing.
Yeah.
And the more I do that, the more that other stuff just kind of tends to slough off of me, and I really stay focused on doing my best to be a good person in this world, and you know, knowing I will make mistakes, and I really focus on wanting to speak the truth. That's a cultural value. It's obviously a personal value of mine, and having grown up in the way that I did, being able to speak about the things that I know that happen to a lot, that are done to a lot of people in this country, it brings me a lot of satisfaction. And I feel like as long as I kind of stay in that, you know, I can let the rest of it go. And, you know, I've had elders, 70s, 80s, come up to me after maybe a talk or a reading or something, you know, and disclose about their childhood sexual violence for the first time. And you can see that healing starting to happen for them. And if I can be a facilitator or conduit of that in any way, shape, or form for other people, it's worth it. It's just worth it to bring forward these issues that are really deeply buried, you know, in our culture.
Yes. What do you teach?
I actually teach writing.
Oh, well, yeah. That would be an interesting thing, being in your class. Talk a little bit about what you how you teach that? What are you, do you teach intense writing, or are you beginning writing, or what do you do?
No, actually I teach at universities and colleges, and I stick to, you know, the composition and sometimes literature. Mm-hmm. So I don't really, you know, bring a lot of this stuff into the classroom.
Right. That's for an upper level course.
yeah, specialized course, right? Yeah,
I wouldn't want to traumatize
my poor 19-year-old students.
Although I'm amazed at what people both do nowadays and are exposed to. Personally, I think there's a lot of desensitization, right? I think a lot of people get so used to seeing really traumatic stuff that I feel like sometimes it just rolls off them or doesn't bother them anymore. My whole goal is I want it to bother you. It should bother you, you know?
Yeah.
Set the stage for me about your book.
About the two Ojibwe teenage girl cousins, Sharon Chris, is set in 1969 in Minnesota. And it follows them just over the course of a few weeks in the summer of 1969 as they leave a fictitious northern Minnesota reservation to come to Minneapolis. And then there's a lot of backstory that's intertwined about their family, about the reservation system here in Minnesota. And then it also branches off into other aspects, historical aspects of Minnesota. It's partially historical fiction. So I guess it is historical fiction, and there are some historical facts and figures that are in the book that just kind of fit in perfectly with the story. So a lot of it is about identity, not just Native identity, but also what we now call white identity, which, of course, you know, 75-100 years ago was quite different than how, quote unquote, white people are perceived in this country. There was, you know, ethnic differences. There was, you know, great religious divides. And also people were still speaking the languages of the European countries that they came from or had very intense cultural ties with their European, mother country, or, you know, whatever they might call it. So it's about a lot of different issues. And the whole book is set in Minnesota.
Mm. You know, I notice you have a lot of history Minnesota, yes, but the lakes and the reservation and how things changed. That's true history, I presume.
Yeah. There's a significant amount of true history, and I kind of tagged it intuitive research. I'm actually an academic. I write academic articles, and I've done academic research. Mm-hmm. And this kind of research, I would say, was intuitive research. I would be like, I know this one piece of information about this part of the story. I know that family's Finnish, but I don't know anything else about them yet. Uh-huh. And then I would do a little bit of research, and it would just like pop out at me just fit in really nicely with the fictional story. So it was really an interesting process for me to write this book, to blend those ways. Was really a lot of fun. And also it was satisfying in the sense that I think that white supremacy in Minnesota, these roots need to be examined, and they really need to be brought forward so that we can all, you know, heal from that and bring about justice and healing in this state, in this country.
Yes, I was going to say, I'm sure it's not just this state, as we will talk about later. How long did it take for you to write this book?
I actually started this book 20 years ago when I was a graduate student at the University of Central Florida. Hmm. And our professor had us write a little like 7 or 10 page imitation of Cormac McCarthy's All the Pretty Horses. And these two characters, they just like jumped on the page, and there they were, and they came with their names and everything.
Wow.
And so my professor took me aside after he read it, and he said, "You have a responsibility to these characters to finish this, turn it into a book." And I remember thinking at the
of
time.
Of course he did.
You know, I can't write a book. Like, but I always carried that sense of responsibility. Mm. And, you know, I think this book has its own reasons, and the story has its own reason and purpose. And I think this is just when it needed to come out.
Talk about, you know, what gave you an interest in this particular story, you know, for writing a story like this? What made you feel like you had to do it?
Well, I think partly my feeling is that, you know, that this story came to me, and I felt responsible and I felt tasked in a sense to write it. And, you know, this is a story of my family. Mm-hmm. This is a story of my community. This is a story of my ancestors. And I don't mean that, you know, in an absolute literal, you know, this is obviously a fictional piece, but it's written out of that spirit. And, you know, I think a lot of times, readers might not understand how much truth is in fiction, and they'll be like, well, I don't want to read that. It's not real. It's fiction. I want to read nonfiction. But when we're writing nonfiction, we're doing a lot more censoring, and, you know, making maybe ourselves look a little better or whatever,
right?
Or not saying something. But with fiction, you've got a green light. And, so this story is, it's about my past too. It's about my community's past.
You talk in the book, about fear of the police and in Carnival Lights. And this is bothersome to me. And it's not just in regards to the Native culture. You know, I think a lot of other cultures, the African-American culture, many other cultures experience fear of the police. And this is sad to me because they're supposed to be the protectors, right? They are supposed to be the ones that look over you, watch out for you, and protect you. But constantly, these two main characters, Shira and Kristen, are terrified of them in some ways, in many ways. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, I don't speak for, you know.
Is that a true feeling, though, in the Native community?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it's absolutely my feeling, too. You know, I think there's a lot of fear of the police. There's a lot of, and it's not just that it's something that's in our head, you know, and we need to get over.
Yes.
It's because the police have been complicit or actual perpetrators. Not every police officer, obviously I'm not saying that, but as an institution, unfortunately, you know, it has had often a very negative impact on the Native community, especially when you're talking about homeless Native people, especially when you're talking about sexually abused, sex trafficked people in general. And then, you know, also particularly Native folks as well. And again, I'm not saying that every police officer is bad or any, you know, that's not what I'm saying. But institutionally, that unfortunately has been the way that it has largely played out in our communities.
Well, unfortunately, you can find people's real videos all the time about how the police are failing in public. And
yeah.
I am hopeful that this will change, but it does feel surprisingly terrifying. And if people don't realize, or if they think they're totally safe and it can never happen to you just because you're white, I really don't think that that's true. And think that it will probably happen less, but you still need to be aware of what's going on. That it's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I've never considered the police to be something that would protect me or that would do anything positive for me. You know, personally, I've never experienced that feeling. And I'm not saying it couldn't happen, but I mean, I'm just, you know, that's just where I'm coming from.
I want to talk about Kristen. She goes through many changes, various changes when she's in the church bathroom. What happens there? Is she just really like looking back on things, or is she having difficulties mentally?
Yeah. So, Chris or Kristen, she goes by both names in the book. Mm-hmm. Her father, abused her and did some things to her mother as well when she was very young. Mm-hmm. And the book exemplifies how she carries that forward, how she survives that. And her cousin Chris, like, will comment on occasion, you know, like she sees Chris going in. Did I say her cousin Chris? Her cousin
yeah.
Cher.
Yeah.
Her cousin Cher comments on occasion about how she will see sort of this chain come over Chris. Mm-hmm. And she calls her little Chris. And so I don't want to give away the, you know, some of the story here.
Right.
So I'll just say that, you know, she was very young when her father was, you know, harming her and her mother. And then that continued on until she left. And when people carry that, and it comes out in a variety of ways. And with her, it's sometimes it's like a regression where she turns into a much younger, you know, part or aspect of herself. Mm-hmm. And sometimes she's kind of cycling through, like Jacob, you know, also in the book, a gay teenage Jewish boy that they meet up with in Minneapolis. They will kind of cycle through some of their trauma. And with his, you know, he's also got a lot of drug abuse that's going on with that.
Yes.
But it's a cycling through of the harm and the different, you know, sometimes people can develop these, what they call dissociation, you know, these states where you know, you're a different age, or you might even be a different, you know, some part of you that adopted a different name in order to survive whatever trauma you went through.
So in the sense, it didn't happen to them. It happened to somebody else.
Right. Yep. Exactly. Exactly. It's a skillful coping mechanism. And, you know, the dominant culture in the U.S., you know, looks at it as a pathology, and it's actually called a disorder. And I was talking to my Wet'en, Earl Hoagland, once about it. Wet'en in the Ojibwe way, he's kind of like a godparent.
Uh-huh.
He was he's passed now, but he was a Indian doctor, a spiritual person. And, you know, he said, oh, what are they saying now? And so I explained to him what that meant. And he said, oh, that's a gift from the spirits.
Ah.
He said, I had to walk all over Canada and the U.S. to learn those ways. And so, you know, I think it's just, that's one of obviously the major themes in the book, right?
Yes.
Are these cultural differences between in this, you know, particular book, the Ojibwe traditions, and then, you know, the dominant white culture that we all exist in.
Mm. Yes. And also how they pass on, you know, their culture and their history, where, and what they choose to pass on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not always everything. They pass on what they feel seems like strength, what they can make their children stronger.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, one of that's, you know, like you're saying, that's something that happens over and over again in the book. And, you know, sometimes people will be like, oh, you know, this book was really about a, you know, there's abuse happening in it, there's homelessness in this. But to me, the book is like, really, like, the backbone of this book is just the love. Mm-hmm. And the cultural traditions and strength of the Ojibwe to be able to survive what our ancestors survived, and what, frankly, we're still surviving in many ways right now. Those ways, I think are very evident in the book. Mm-hmm. And I remember getting those kinds of teachings from my grandmothers. You couldn't talk about it specifically or, you know, outwardly, but you made those teachings evident by how you lived and the ways that you treated people.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot of that from my grandmother's, and I'm very, very thankful for that. They were models for me that were very different from some of the other people in my life who were, you know, very violent and destructive. And I could survive that because I had my grandmothers in my life to show me another way, to model that for me. And so there's a lot of that happening in the book. And, you know, a lot of people aren't aware that indigenous religious ways or spiritual ways, mm-hmm. our ceremonies, were outlawed in the United States of America until 1978. It was illegal to practice our traditions and our cultures in this country until 1978.
The land of religious freedom, huh?
Yep. Yeah.
Unreal. We need to take another short station break, and we'll be right back.
Programming on KFAI is supported by Metro Transit. Metro Transit now offers use of an app that connects blind and low vision customers to a live agent for navigation assistance during transit trips. More information at metrotransit.org/AIRA.
And this is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. We're talking with Kristen Stark, and my name is Sam. We're talking about a new book that's called Carnival Lights. And Chris, you sent me something that was rather horrifying. You tend to do that. And it was in your book as well, on how dozens and dozens of children are taken from their homes and families by social workers. I presume it was more prevalent then, although I'm not sure. But it's still happening. Can please inform us?
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. So you could talk to a lot of folks, a lot of Native people that grew up on the reservations or in urban areas. And the social workers would come out onto the reservation, and the kids knew to run and hide because the social workers were potentially coming out there to take them away, and they may not ever return. And so that's something that, you know, does happen in Carnival Lights, where the social workers come out, and the grandparents of Chris and Cher, you know, are very conscious of that and conscious of hiding, mm-hmm. having the girls hide, and then also of trying to placate the social workers to protect their families. And I actually have a friend, Sam Emery, who I, in part dedicated the book to, and she had that experience. Her and her sister were 4 and 5 years old, and a social worker came out onto the White Earth Reservation. This would have been back in, I think, the 40s or 50s. And the girls were with their family, and the social worker took them, and she adopted them out to a Greek family in Minneapolis. And the girls were raised as Greek. And Sam did not know that she was Anishinaabe until she was 27 years old.
Wow.
And certainly many, many people in the Native communities have been, you know, lost for good through that process. So that is, you know, it happens in this fictional story in Carnival Lights, but that is a very prevalent experience. And I appreciate you saying that you presume that that's not the case anymore. However, I often talk about how, institutions or systems, they might change, but they just sort of modify themselves. And so actually what we have right now, we have federal legislation that was created in thanks to Native people in the 1970s, really pushing against Native children being removed from their families and communities. And it's called ICWA, Indian Child Welfare Act. It's federal legislation. Despite this federal legislation, more Native children are removed from their families and their communities than during the boarding school era. And, it's quite a horrifying story. I would really like to encourage, you know, folks to look into this more and be good allies to the Native community, and however they might be able to do that. But for instance, the state of South Dakota makes half of its revenue off of the removal of Indian children from their families.
I think I heard 56 or 57%.
Yeah.
So, you know, some people might think, and this is with any culture, that there's some amount of abuse in homes, and they might think, well, certainly they are taking the kids that are getting abused away. That would be good, right? But that's not the fact at all. That's, I presume some of them are in abusive situations, but they're just taking dozens and dozens of them.
Yeah, and, you know, there's just like a double standard that exists in CPS. I actually have an MSW, mm-hmm. a master's in social work, you know, so I've been in this field in a variety of ways. But there's, you know, there's just a double standard that exists between especially white wealthy families or middle class families versus, you know, families that are struggling financially, and then versus, you know, race issues. So you look at African American and Native children, and they're taken at much higher rates than white children. And the issue with the Native community is that even if the children are in a situation that maybe they need to be removed for a while the parents can get back on their feet or deal with, you know, whatever mm-hmm. Neglect the children might be experiencing, they're supposed to stay in the community. They're supposed to stay in the Native community so that they don't end up like Sam, you know, not even knowing that they're right. Indian, not being raised with cultures, not being raised in the community, but they're not. So, you know, you have this, again, you have this federal legislation, it's federal law, and it's not followed. You know, there were 500 treaties signed in this country between indigenous nations and the U.S. government. And you know how many of them were broken? 500.
I was going to say every one of them.
Every one of them by the U.S. government. You know, so it's... It speaks to, right, like the vast or the chasm between cultures and how we view institutions in this country. You know, if you come from a Native community or you come from an African American community, you know, or you know, other communities, you're going to look on these institutions very, very differently because of your own experiences and your community's experiences with these institutions and their double standards. Mm.
I want to talk as well about something that was stated in the video I saw in regards to that the children taken, that there are communities out there that get money for children that have learning disabilities, and that the children, these particular children, Indigenous children, are taken and tested. They don't pass the tests, and so they get money for them. Can you talk? Did I misunderstand?
Yeah, I think that some of it is that they're tested, but I've also known it to happen, whereas if they're Native, they're just automatically check marked as like learning disabled or some other kind of disability. And then they get more money. The state gets more money for each of those children if they're marked as learning disabled or another kind of disability. They make even more money off of those children. So really what that is that's sex trafficking. I mean, not sex trafficking, that's trafficking of children. Like that's selling Indian children and the state making money off of them and removing them from the community. And the continuation of, you know, the disconnection from one generation to the next and how harmful that has been and continues to be for Native people.
Well, and anybody who might be out there, I know schools handle things differently. Sometimes I've seen elementary schools take kids out of class. This would be a problem if you're labeled learning disabled, because then you're not getting the same education necessarily as your peers, and you may not be learning disabled.
Right.
The lucky ones may be the ones that have the in-class teachers that come in, and then presumably they could show differently. But I don't know how one stops something like this.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's something that we're, many of us are often, you know, asking ourselves, like, what can be done about this? How do we combat something that is so systemic and entrenched and powerful, right? Just very powerful. We're talking about, you know, the government, basically. So, and then also when you get into, you know, CPS and you get into foster care, that is where there's a lot of sex trafficking that makes those kids really vulnerable to sex traffickers too. And so we see all of these issues and how they intertwine in the lives of individuals and in the lives of communities. And I think that, you know, in whatever ways that we can bring forward this information, like what you're doing, it's just really crucial. And for people to read more and to learn more and to see how they can act as good allies to the Native community and work alongside, or, you know, find out how they can help the Native community combat this, you know, with Native people leading the way, of course.
Do you by chance have the link of that video that you gave to me? If you don't, I do have it, and so I will do my best to put it on the webpage so people can go watch and listen to that.
I don't have it, you know, on me. I would have to look it up as well, but I would, you know, really encourage people to take a look at that. The ACLU is, you know, has stepped up to help the families in South Dakota, the Native families in South Dakota, with this situation. And you know, that's the kind of thing that we need more of, is those kind of collaborations, because a lot of times, you know, Native communities and a lot of times Native individuals, we don't have the kind of resources that maybe some other communities do.
This particular video was talking about both South Dakota and Texas, but South Dakota certainly was the first one. I presume there might be other states that are involved in this too, but I was just quite amazed. It felt startling that even the governor of the state was afraid to do anything about it. Like, there was so much money in so much of this that people just didn't want to touch it. And I thought, where's the human decency?
Yeah.
How do you...
And that's one of the things Carnival Lights is really about, you know, like, it's really about that, you know, we have a spirit called the Wendigo, and it's a cannibal spirit. Mm. And so, you know, I think that kind of, idea of there being an energy or a spirit, you know, that is a cannibal like that. I think we can see a lot of examples of that in the dominant culture as well, really cannibalizing, you know, destroying the earth, the water, the land, the trees, the animals, and human beings.
You have, I think, a particular way, and I'm sure maybe writing does it for you, that of getting this out. And you don't feel angry to me, although in order to speak about it, I'm sure speaking about it helps. But how do you retain, you know, how do you maintain from not being so angry?
Well, certainly I've gone through plenty of anger, you know, especially, you know, younger. And for me, that anger was protective. And that anger kept me from being annihilated because of the violence that I was going through, that I experienced, that people committed against me, even as a very young child. And so I'm grateful for that anger, because it kept me alive. But, you know, like I said, once I came back to Minnesota and I got involved, you know, again, in the Ojibwe community and in the traditions and the ceremonies, you know, it just continually healing. And, I'll always be healing all of my life. But I guess the feeling, like I said earlier, the feeling of speaking about this and the gratitude that I have for being able to be heard. Like, I'm grateful to be on the show to bring forward these issues and make the truth known in the ways that I can participate in that process, because there's a lot of people who have a lot of different information that the rest of us need to hear. There's things I need to hear from other people, you know, and by speaking about that and speaking the truth, it gives me a sense of peace.
Well, you're very welcome, and I hope this does something. I wanted the two girls in the book, and I call them girls because they really are. They're quite young, mm-hmm. Shir mm-hmm. and Chris. It's a huge difference with their personalities. Not only that, but how what I call street smart they are. And Chris, who I would have expected would be more street smart, is like not. And Shir feels very street smart, or at least, and I presume some of those instincts develop from that. But she had a fairly stable family. You know, we all have our deals with our families, but hers felt more stable. So what do you think creates that term, the street smart? And I'm not sure that's the correct term, but it's survival instinct, street smart, whatever you want to call it. What creates that in people? And some more than others.
The way that I see that with Sharon, Chris, and that I am hoping that people, you know, when they read the book, that they'll have a deeper understanding of that and awareness of that. Both of those girls, you know, grew up on a reservation in a rural area. Mm-hmm. It's a fictitious reservation, but I put it just west of Duluth. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't have city stuff. I mean, all this stuff that, you know, you would have seen coming into the city would have been brand new. Cher had been here once before, but it would have been brand new to Chris. And mm-hmm. it's, you know, mesmerizing, right? In mm-hmm. a lot of ways. But Chris Cher was not abused growing up, and Chris's father abused her horribly. Mm. And that, you know, that impacts people, and some people might be really, you know, they might be really street smart or whatever, but Chris, you know, that harmed her in a way that made her very vulnerable. It made her vulnerable to the bright lights and baubles of the carnival.
Mm, yeah.
You know, the dominant culture carnival that you know, the United States is, right?
Right.
It made her vulnerable to that because she had, you know, holes in her, you know, her being and her emotions. And there are perpetrators out there, you know, like I reference in the book, it's very easy to see that in people, really. It's easy to spot that. You can just observe people often and see that very clearly in the way they move their body, the way they react to things. And so she's very vulnerable because of that. And Cher really does her best to protect her, right?
Mm, yeah.
But I think that, you know, people like to really blame sexual abuse victims because then they don't have to look at the fact that, like, we have an organized system in this country that targets people for rape, and there are people who make money off of it. And we would rather talk about how that 14-year-old girl did something quote unquote wrong and brought this about on her than to take a real hard look at this institution of sexual violence in this country. And I hope that people will read this book and start to have more awareness and empathy and understanding, especially for young people who have been abused. I mean, also with Jacob as well, you know, you can just really see how damaged he is.
Mm, yeah.
By the sexual violence, but also as a descendant of survivors of the Shoah or the Jewish Holocaust. Because, you know, we can't separate, really, especially in this book, you can't separate the sexual violence and the you know, what these young people are experiencing, either as Jewish or Native kids, from their ancestors' past, and the genocide, the attempted genocide against Jewish people and Native people. They're not inseparable.
Chris, first of all, I want to ask my research team, Charlene. Charlene, do you have any questions in regards to Chris's topic tonight?
No, it is a powerful book, and I really think people should read it and understand more about our natives, the people that were here first, and how we're treating them so poorly.
Chris, can you tell us how you can get the book?
Yeah, you can get the book anywhere books are sold. Certainly Amazon and other online places. And then our local bookstores are great sources. And, you know, it's good to keep them in business.
Yes, definitely. I have been sad in more ways than one when a bookstore that I loved closed because online things were higher. And I love local bookstores, right? You know, there's something to be said. Even the big chain bookstores that are here with a visible building, they hold a lot. And just when's the last time somebody brought their kid into a bookstore? It's amazing things. And I really miss Border Books. I loved that store. It was an amazing store for both kids and adults. Can you tell me, talk about... We're going back to this, you know, I think I assumed that all things were somewhat created equal. I always knew there was discrimination. I mean, all you have to do is have a disability and you know there's discrimination. There always is. It's not a fair playing field. It never has been. I'm probably a little bit of a cynic, but I hope someday I can say there will be, but I'm not seeing it yet. It surprised me when I saw you talk about the Hiawatha insane asylums that existed in South Dakota. Do they still have it?
No, it ended. It was 1934, I believe, when it ended. But it was in Canton, South Dakota, and it was the Hiawatha insane asylum for Indians. And it was the second quote unquote insane asylum to be federally funded by the US government. And Native people were brought there from all over the country for infractions like, speaking against a BIA agent or disagreeing, you know, with a white person, especially a white person in a position of authority. So it was really more of a substitute for jail than anything else. And they also made money off of the people in the asylum in a similar way that they made money off of a lot of the boarding school students by sending them to farmers during the summer and having them work in the fields or in the house ironing as domestic labor. So the idea, you know, the pathologizing of any kind of difference by our dominant culture, like you're talking about around disability, around sexual orientation, being lesbian or gay was considered, it was in the DSM until the 1970s. You know, it's just really a pathology of anything that is different from what is, you know, believed to be right or the norm or whatever we want to say. And I think that, Tony Troyer, a Ojibwe professor at Bemidji, you know, he talks a lot about the value of Ojibwe culture and traditions and language and ways of seeing the world. We all bring our gifts as individuals and all cultures bring their gifts too. And so I think that it's not just a matter of pity or something, but it's like, what can we learn from Indigenous people? What can we learn from these other cultures that have been discriminated against? What can we learn against individuals what can we learn from individuals who have disabilities?
I would like to try to push the media as well. I think, I think a lot of people think, well, how come I never heard about this? You know, this is stuff you don't hear about. That, but I'd like to take this moment to say, you know, the high, you know, visibility of media that is really popular circulates about 7 or 8 stories, you know, and they just keep going round and round. And occasionally you hear another one creep in, but generally it's 7 or 8 stories for that week or whatever it is. You know, the most high story that gets really popularity will win the, this is what we talk about. So I encourage you to really do research and to look into the things like this, because they are there and they are around, and you can find things about them actually, unfortunately, more easily than you think you can. You just have to look, you know, beyond the most popular news places.
Yeah, and support KFAI.
That's right. Thank you. Woohoo! Chris, is there any final things you want to say about your book and anything else?
I like I said, I just really appreciate being on here. I'm always grateful when people read my work. I'm grateful for that. And, you know, I just am sending this book out into the world and with hopes of it bringing about some kind of justice and healing in whatever, you know, maybe small way that it might do that. And, you know, I think one of the most basic teachings, you know, from my elders is that, you know, every day that you wake up is a gift, because it's another day that you're alive.
Yeah.
And to just really remember that and to, you know, live out of gratitude for being here and being part of this world, no matter how hard it is and how unfair and just and cruel it can be. There's still a lot of beauty and love in the world. And we make that choice every day about how we want to live that day and be in that day.
Thank you so much, Chris. And what is there something that is coming up? I know it's not been too long since you released this, right?
Yeah, it just came out actually in July. So
I guess I shouldn't pressure you and say, what's next?
I'm working on a nonfiction book, actually. There's going to be a lot of historical research about the roots of MMIW, Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women.
Okay.
Here in the U.S. So that's what's up next for me. And I'm also doing a reading at the Loft in November with Susan Mona Power, who's an amazing Dakota art writer. And she's got a new book coming out about the boarding schools as well. So check the Loft. Of course, I don't remember the date, but check the Loft website, because I think it's going to be a really good reading, and her work is just incredible.
Do you want people to have any contact info for you?
Oh, yeah. Christine with a C-H, stark.com is my website. And I always love to hear from people.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's been great talking with you.
Yeah, good talking with you. Thank you so much for everything you do.
Take care.
All right, you too.
This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFEI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I've been the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research team. This is KFEI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFEI.org. If you'd like to be on our email list, you may email us at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. We've been speaking tonight with Chris Stark. She was talking about her novel, Carnival Lights. This is Disability and Progress. Good night.
KFEI.